It got started back in the 80s, actually, the late 80s. I was a kind of new clinical ethicist, and I was witnessing these frequent occasions where generally elderly patients would have some new major medical crisis, and their families then were asked to decide whether we would continue or discontinue medical treatment. And I was getting involved in these discussions with the families to help them through these decisions. And what struck me again and again and again is that families repeatedly had no idea of what their mother or father would really want them to do. And this level of uncertainty about the patient's wishes created great moral distress for families and left them with just really complete uncertainty about what decision to make, despite the fact that a decision had to be made. It appeared to me that the consequences of this were a lifelong distress for family members. What I asked is, why aren't we asking our patients about their preferences at a time when they're still well, since most of these patients were well known to us and often in our care on a frequent basis? So we had opportunity to plan. We just simply weren't doing it. And so Gunderson really stepped up and said, okay, let's figure out how to do this. How do we engage, at least offer the opportunity for all of our patients to think about these decisions, to think about them clearly and well, and to talk with their family about them so that when such a crisis occurs, we would know what the patient wants, we here being both the physicians as well as the family.
Certainly, these are not easy conversations to have with any patient. How do you go about starting that conversation in the proper way, I guess?
Well, you're right. These are and certainly can be very hard conversations. I think all too often they're made harder because the question is, well, what do you want if you're dying? I don't think that's actually the right question to ask. First of all, we want to know who would make decisions if you became incapable. This could be a life or death situation, or it could be just one where you're going to recover, but you can't make your decisions now. So who's going to make your decisions? And the real focus here is on really asking this question. What does good care look like if you suffer a serious injury or illness from which you're unlikely to recover? How do we take good care of you? That question people actually can, I think, approach in a self-interested way. They know that things are going to happen, and they want good care, and they want a voice in defining what that good care looks like. That question doesn't seem so frightening to people. And from our perspective, when the right questions are asked, we can almost universally engage our patients and their families in answering those questions.
And Dr. Hammes, one of the things I'm sure that you're talking about with end-of-life care is the decision, you know, where do you want to be at the end of your life if there's, you know, a terminal condition that affects you? And are you finding that more and more patients are choosing to spend those final days in a home setting rather than in the hospital?
Right. So I think there's a kind of universal human desire if the end is close, and medical care really can't change that outcome, not to receive a lot more medical care, certainly not to come to the hospital and be poked and prodded and lose your privacy. So when the end is close, people prefer to remain in their own residence, but they want to be around people that they're familiar with, in a setting that they're familiar with, and they want to be cared for thoughtfully and maintain their comfort.
How do you think we got to the point where those conversations just were not happening on a regular basis?
Well, I think the absence of these conversations, first of all, from my experience here at Gunderson, they just weren't part of the routine of care. Healthcare is driven a lot by routine and by the kind of medical culture, and it just wasn't part of what people did. And so they didn't know how to do it. The workflows and interactions that are needed weren't kind of designed into the system. And so they just didn't happen. And telling people they should do it didn't help because they didn't actually have a system which allowed them to do it at all. So you could tell people to do it, and they could even say, I want to do that, but you know, you got 15-minute appointments and you're seeing one patient after another, you're not going to have time to have these 30 to 60-minute conversations. So what we did, I think, that was different was to say we have to redesign how we interact with patients so that advanced care planning becomes an activity and interaction that was not only possible but actually routine. But that takes some redesign of the workflows in the healthcare system. It requires retraining of people to work in those health those workflows. It means helping them understand what are the right questions to ask, to how to approach patients and their families. It means literally having space in which these conversations can occur when the patient wants them to occur.
What do you think has been the most challenging aspect of that process you're talking about to actually implement for most healthcare systems?
The biggest challenge we see is that, for the most part, the service that you're providing to the patient and their family can take, you know, let's just say on average 45 to 60 minutes. That's a lot of time. But that's the actual amount of time that patients need to plan well. So time, as we all know, equals money, and generally this kind of service is not reimbursed by anyone. So how do health systems who are already being kind of strapped and constrained by lower and lower payments, how do they actually pay for the service they're providing to patients to do advanced care planning? I think that remains the biggest barrier. We know how to do it. We know how to do it well. We know how to do the redesign. But how do you actually do it in a way which is sustainable and make it available to the population who really could benefit from such planning?